So we have 10 more classes left in the lecture series. In these 10 classes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how the American Empire will fall, and I will show you that what will replace the American Empire is Israel, what we call Pax Judaica. So for these next 10 classes, we will do an overview of history and show you why history will lead ultimately to the Pax Judaica, okay? All right, so let's do some questions from YouTube that my wife has picked out. She reads all the comments. She loves reading the comments, and she sends comments to me to reply to, okay? So the first comment is, how do we restore our right hemisphere, or how do we become more creative? And the answer is that you have to reject materialism. That's the only way, okay? You have to reject money, you have to reject power, you have to reject materialism in order to embrace your creativity and your right hemisphere. As a society, what will have to happen is a major crisis that threatens our very existence for us to come together and for us to be more altruistic and more creative. A possibility is that if you really want to activate your right hemisphere, then you fall in love and you have children. Or you could also choose to volunteer, help other people, be kind and generous to other people, okay? So that's how you activate your right hemisphere. Second question is, do you only give lessons to one class? How's your journey to find some LSD? Okay, so I'm only teaching one lecture series, but to three different sections, okay? LSD, psychedelics, you know, I'm very interested in psychedelics. I myself do not want to partake in psychedelics because I don't really understand why I need to. I read a lot of books. I practice a very altruistic lifestyle, and therefore I don't feel as though I need psychedelics to break out of this materialistic world. Okay, I'm already connected to the divine. So yeah. Okay, let's move on. All right, some more questions. Could you make a video on how to understand history without bias? And a response is, first of all, it's impossible to be unbiased, okay? And that is correct. We're all subjective. So he suggests that you have to look at documents and try to be really critical when you analyze documents. And that's correct as well, okay? The problem is that often we don't have documentation. Or we have documentation from only one source. So it's very hard to do. So what I'm trying to do with this class is try to propose a new theory of how to understand history. And if you adopt this model, I guarantee you that your understanding of history will improve, and also your understanding of how the world works will improve as well. So there are three components to this new history model, which I call predictive history, okay? The first is to understand historical patterns. And so when you try to look at history and the event there, you ask yourself, does this fit into a larger pattern or model of history? If it does, it's probably correct. If it doesn't, then there's something wrong here, okay? Second tool is the idea of game theory. And the idea of game theory is to understand that all historical actors are motivated by their interests or worldview. And so are you looking at all different historical actors, and are you trying to figure out what their best strategy is, okay? And the third facet is the idea of religious eschatological. What this means is that all cultures, all individuals have a certain religious outlook, a religious worldview. And you can often find this worldview within their sacred texts, for example, the Bible or the Quran, okay? And these texts will give you insight as to how they perceive history, but also how they want history to eventually develop, so you can understand the strategies moving forward, okay? All right, and we will look at these three strategies, and we will adapt them for our historical understanding, okay? All right, another question is, this is really interesting. The question is, most of the greats across history were not Jewish. The domination by Jews of various industries is a relatively new phenomenon. Is it possible that their creativity and power is a result of political shifts in education in the Bible? Okay, this is a really good criticism of my previous lecture. The idea is that maybe there's certain aspects of the Jewish culture that makes them dominant in an industrial, capitalistic, globalized world. And there is some truth to that. But I often think about Chinese people, because Chinese people are extremely materialistic. Like, Chinese love money. But we're not as creative as Jewish people. So I think that being materialistic, being capitalistic, it's not enough. You also need to have an element of creativity within your culture. And that's why I think that the Bible helps us better understand the success of Jews better, okay? So this is a really good point. And also, what's really important to understand is that this is a class on intellectual speculation, okay? We're trying to figure out theories. We're trying to play with ideas. There's no truth there, okay? So take everything I say with a grain of salt, doubt whatever I say. This class is really meant to be a platform or a jumping board for you to undertake your own intellectual journey, okay? All right, so please keep that in mind. But we're going to look more closely at this question today. Okay, why is it that Jews are so dominant? So we will look at the beginning of the Jewish people. And I'm going to make the argument to you that Israel and the Jewish identity are constructs of the imperial imagination. Okay, and this is hard to understand, so I'm explaining it to you slowly. But the idea is that because of its geographic location, Israel has always been historically important. And as a result, different empires have tried to manipulate the identity of Israel to best promote their own agenda or policies. Okay, so I know this is a hard concept to understand, but we'll go for it slowly. And again, we're spending like the rest of the semester on this major thesis of ours. Okay, so let's talk about history. Okay, so what we did last week is look at the cultures that have emerged at the Bronze Age collapse, which are now going to dominate history. Okay, they are the Greeks, the Persians, and the Israelites. Okay, now we're going to look at how these ideas play out in history. But for us to do that, we first need to understand how history works. Now, I've identified three different patterns of geopolitics, okay? And I want you guys to remember these patterns. The first pattern is this. This is really important to understand. Competition within nation states are what matter, okay? Competition between nation states don't really matter, or they're not as significant as competition within nation states. And the idea we have here is elite overproduction. So what drives a lot of conflict is the fact that domestically you have these different competing factions and they're all competing for power, okay? So you have too many elites, too few status positions, and so they're competing against each other. And this drives a lot of conflict, okay? So that's the first idea. Second idea is that the elite have shifting loyalties, okay? Think of Game of Thrones. I'm not sure if you guys have seen the TV series or read the books Game of Thrones, but everyone wants to be king, right? And they're going to kill their brother. They're going to kill their father. They're going to kill their mother to be king. Okay? And so the elite don't really have loyalties except to themselves. The world is just a Game of Thrones. Okay? Now, third thing is that war can be a mechanism to protect the status quo. All right? The idea of equilibrium in that sometimes the conflict is really bad. So what you do, you start a war so you can start off people to get killed. Okay? And that way you can maintain equilibrium within your system. And we'll see this we'll see this pattern throughout human history. Okay? So these are the three ideas I want you guys to remember as we move on and discuss world history. All right. So I want to give us an example for us to understand. Okay, think of the Warring States period of China before the emergence of the first empire, the Qing Empire. Okay, and as you can see from this map, China is divided into different warring states that are all powerful. And at this time in history, the Qing state is the poorest, it's the most isolated, and it is the least advanced. Okay, you can see that Chu, Zhao, they are more powerful. And you can argue that eventually one of them would emerge to unite all of China, but they did not. It was the Qing, the isolated, marginalized, backward state that came to conquer. And so the question is, why did this happen? And so if we use our three principles, right, we can understand why. These three states, these different states are not competing against each other. It's the elites within these states are competing against each other, okay? Elite overproduction. So the way they manage this is for them to use warfare in order to maintain the status quo, to create equilibrium, okay? And how we know is from this time emerges the idea of Chinese chess, right? What is Chinese chess? Chinese chess is the idea of warfare that is regulated, that is ritualized. Okay, so when we go to war, when we battle each other, we have to respect each other's the rules of the warfare. That's stupid. War should be about killing the other guy. It shouldn't be about following the rules, okay? Also, another piece of evidence is, at this time in history, Sun Tzu wrote the book The Art of War. This is one of the stupidest books ever written, okay? I guarantee you, if you follow this book, you're going to lose the war badly. Because this is really about how to cheat in a heavily regulated game, okay? So things like using spies, making a high ground, okay? They have all these rules. And guess what? In an actual war, none of these things actually work, okay? So if you look at history, I'm going to tell you exactly how to win a war, okay? And the way you win a war is, first of all, you have to be completely committed to winning this war. Okay, total warfare. Second is that if you want to win this war, you have to make sure that talent arises. So you have to be open and meritocratic. Okay, if an officer or a general is winning this war, you promote him. That sounds easy, right? But not if you're status quo power. Because what's important to you is to maintain that your family is always on top. So if a general arises who is very innovative, who's really talented, you kill him because he's a threat to you. Okay, so the third principle is make sure your soldiers are happy. I know this sounds really simple, but again, if you're a status quo power, you don't really care. Okay, destroy enemy civilian centers, siege warfare. Okay, go and destroy the city because that's how they produce their war capacity, right? The food, the soldiers, right? Kill civilians, destroy supply lines. Overstretch your enemy, divide and conquer, strike fear in your enemy, kill their gods, okay? If you really want a war, if you really want to win a war, this is what you have to do. And we know because this is what the Romans did. This is what the Prussians did. This is what the Aztecs did. This is what the conquistadors did. Okay? This is what the Mongols did. Every single power that has conquered everyone else has done all these things, okay? So when they don't do these things, it's because these different warring states aren't actually at war with each other. They're actually friends, okay? They're all intermarried with each other. They're all trying to maintain the status quo. They use war as a game in order to maintain the status quo, to create equilibrium, okay? So this is true for Mesopotamia, okay? Mesopotamia is important because remember, this is the cradle of civilization. This is where the first empires will emerge. This is where most technological innovation happens. This was, for the longest time, the wealthiest part of the world. Okay, so remember, the idea of Mesopotamia is that this first city-state is Uruk, and then they will develop colonies throughout the Tigris and Euphrates, and then these colonies will come into war with each other. And they're all friends of each other. They're all intermarried. And the elite create these highly ritualized warfare, okay? And one really important rule is that you don't kill each other's god, okay? Because in their religion, the god lives in their temple. So you don't attack their temple. But guess what? All their money, all their gold is in the temple, okay? So you're not allowed to steal each other's gold. That's stupid, okay? Because now you really don't accomplish that much with warfare. So for the longest time, this was the status quo. And then what will happen is a man named Luca Zagazzi, okay? And you can think of him as lower nobility. So what we'll see in history is that within a city-state, there's always been conflict between the upper nobility and the lower nobility, okay? The upper nobility is in charge. They want to maintain the status quo. The Roman nobility want to steal that power, okay? This will happen in Rome, where Julius Caesar is of the lower nobility, and he will steal the power from the upper nobility, okay? The people call the Optimates. And so Luca Legazzi is from Uma, and he's like, you know what, screw this. These rules are stupid. I want to conquer everyone. I want to be the top dog, okay? So what he's doing that's very different from previous times is he's now going and ransacking each city's temple. So now he has the capacity to people build an empire, okay? But by doing that, what happens is that the other city-states recognize him as a threat, and so they invite mercenaries, a place called Akkad, to come and help them, okay? And this leads us to the first world empire called the Akkadian Empire, named by Sargon of Akkad. Now, his name is interesting. His name means legitimate ruler, which probably tells us he's not a legitimate ruler. He's probably a mercenary like David who stole the throne, okay? He saw an opportunity and he stole the throne. But this is a pattern in history where if there's competition among different city-states, the competition is not resolved amongst themselves because they have an equilibrium. So what happens is that an outsider, a mercenary, usually comes in who doesn't respect the rules and he's able to unite everyone, okay, through innovations. So this is why the Qing Dynasty and not the Zhao or the Chu or the Wei were able to unite all of China, because the Qing Dynasty was committed to total warfare. They didn't care about your rules. They wanted to win. Okay? All right, so as you can see, the Akkadian Empire stretches throughout the Fertile Crescent, okay? Conquers Mesopotamia, modern Iraq, extends over to Anatolia, and captures a lot of the Levant, okay? But this area, the Levant, is historically the most strategic location in the world. Why? Because it gives you access to Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Anatolia. Historically, the three wealthiest parts of the world. So whoever controls the Levant is able to always threaten Egypt, okay? And for most of history, this part, the Levant, was an Egyptian colony. But remember that after the Bronze Age collapsed, Egypt was not able to project power in the Levant, and so the different empires fought for the Levant in order to threaten Egypt, okay? So Jerusalem is literally the center of the world. And we'll see that throughout history, people have considered Jerusalem the center of the world, both for religious reasons, but also mainly for geopolitical and trade reasons, okay? Now, the other thing to remember about this area is that it's highly competitive because it's hard to protect Mesopotamia. Okay, it's very, very wealthy, but as you can see, there are these mountain tribes over here that can always threaten Mesopotamia, okay? So this is a pattern in history where whoever established an empire in Mesopotamia is always going to be threatened by the mountains, the borderlands. Okay, this is a pattern throughout Mesopotamian history, and that's why these empires change all the time. Okay, so this is the Babylonian Empire. This gives us Hammurabi. Okay, then you have the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire is famous for their brutality. They'll come if you rebel against them; they will kill everyone. Okay, they're notorious for their brutality. Now remember, at this time in history, an empire is not the empire of today where you can exert authority everywhere. An empire at this time is you're mainly controlling certain choke points of trade, and everyone else just sort of like goes along because it benefits them. Okay, so an empire is more like a loose confederation as opposed to a nation state. Okay, so this is the Assyrian Empire. And this is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, okay? So you have these empires that constantly change over time. History changes when a man emerges called Cyrus the Great, okay? Cyrus the Great is the founder of something called the Persian Achaemenid Empire. So last class, we discussed Zoroastrianism. And Zoroastrianism is really the first great world religion because it provides a simple but powerful model of how the world works. And Zoroastrianism is powerful because it encourages everyone to be their best, right? To seek Asha. Now, For most people, what ASHA means is don't ever lie, okay? And it's actually a really useful thing if you're trying to run an empire. Because when you run an empire, you need soldiers, you need generals, you need administrators, right? And if people don't lie, if people are honest and moral, well, you can expand really quickly, right? And so that's what Cyrus the Great did. Cyrus the Great is also known for his mercy and his generosity. So when he conquers a place, what he will do is he will identify the best people, maybe even the king himself, and make them advisors to his regime. Okay, he's known for his tolerance. He's known for his openness. And so what happens is that the Babylonian Empire basically surrendered to him without a fight. Why? Because of elite overproduction, right? You have this war going on between the upper nobility and the lower nobility, and they're like, you know what? Let's just invite Cyrus the Great, and then we don't have to fight each other anymore, okay? And that's how Cyrus the Great was able to build the first world empire, okay? This is Babylon, the fall of Babylon, and Cyrus the Great, there are different stories, but one story is that the elite basically invited him in order to resolve their inner conflicts with each other, okay? This is a tomb of Cyrus the Great. It's still in Iran today. There's a story that when Alexander the Great, you know, who was Macedonian, when he went to conquer the Persian Empire, he discovered that the Cyrus the Great, his tomb, was in bad repair. They didn't really maintain or upkeep it. So he ordered for it to be properly maintained, okay? That's probably, the story is by the way, probably false. But it shows you that at this time in history, about the year 300, 400, 300, 400 BCE, everyone was respectful of Cyrus the Great, okay? Cyrus the Great is considered the world's greatest king or emperor. Okay, so as you can see, the Achaemenid Persian Empire is huge. Okay, it encompasses most of West Asia. Okay, so it goes from Iran all the way to Mesopotamia, to Anatolia, to parts of Greece, and basically all of Egypt and Libya. Okay, it's a huge area. And they were able to do this because of their innovations in religion as well as administration. Okay? All right, so let me explain. How do you rule empires usually, okay? Well, the traditional way is you control trade routes and access, okay? So people have to pay you a tax to go through your trade routes. That's a traditional way. You can also use fear and conquest, and that's what the Assyrians were known for. They would come and they would kill everyone if you disobeyed them. You took hostages. That's a very common thing where you conquer people and you take the children of the king as hostages, okay? Intermarriage, religion. But what the Persians did really well that allowed for the Persian Empire to be so huge, as well as to be really well managed, are four things, okay? Effective administration. Again, when you have a religion, Zoroastrianism, where people can't lie, that's really good because these bureaucrats will now report real facts to the emperor, and that allows him to make better decisions, okay? Elite cooptation, meritocracy. And the idea here is that if you have a very effective administration that allows for local elites to focus your energies on trying to join this administration as opposed to rebelling against you. Communication, networks, okay? So things like roads, things like postal networks, okay? So the Persians create the first global postage system. And it was really effective where if you want to send mail from Egypt over to Mesopotamia, what would happen is you would have these royal roads where people would ride on horses and they could stop at a hostile rest and then keep on going, okay? And that way you can very quickly move information from one corner of the empire to the other. Okay? And the last is to divide and rule. Divide and rule is really important. So what they did was they basically had different power centers within a region. Okay, so you had the satraps, which were the local governors, but then you also had the local, you also had the bureaucrats, okay? You also had the royal representatives. So these were different factions within a region, okay? So divide and rule is probably the most effective way to control an empire. Okay, So now let's move on to Israel. Okay, we now know about the Persian Empire, how they managed their system and why they are so effective. Okay, now let's talk about Israel. So remember that we read the Bible, and the Bible came about because David needed to justify, legitimize his rule. And after the Bronze Age collapsed, David created a Davidic kingdom in the Levant, because Egypt, Anatolia, Mesopotamia were preoccupied, right? But because the Levant is so important, this Davidic kingdom doesn't really last that long. It lasts for like 80 to 100 years, okay? After Solomon, David's son, dies, Israel is divided into two parts. The northern kingdom, which gets conquered by Assyria, as well as Judah, okay? Jerusalem, which tries to maintain the Davidic kingdom, but doesn't last very long. At this time in history, the Israelites are being pulled in different directions, okay? The Anatolians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, because they are strategically very important. And so what's really hard for these empires is, how do we maintain control over Jerusalem? Okay, and they try different techniques. They try burning down their city centers, okay? So the Northern Kingdom was destroyed. You might have heard of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. They tried taking hostages, okay? But because this region is so volatile, nothing really works. And so the Jerusalem, the Israelites keep on rebelling. Okay? So this is the kingdom of Judah. And what happens is, for the longest time, the Babylonians are trying to deal with the Israelites, okay? So they take hostages. Okay, they take hostages, like thousands of them, and move them to Babylon, where they become scribes, where they become farmers, where they become merchants. Okay, but again, the region is so strategically important that Jerusalem, the Israelites, they switch loyalties all the time. Eventually, the Babylonians are so pissed off that they decide to burn down their temple. Okay, and so at this point in history, the Israelites are now gone. Okay, does that make sense? The Israelites are gone now. 587 to 6, we don't know when, but Babylon's destroyed Jerusalem because they cannot, they tried many techniques to try to control Jerusalem. They can't do it. The Israelites are too rebellious, but it's too strategically important, so they destroy, so they decide, you know what, screw this, we'll just destroy the city, okay? So when this happens, okay, this is really important to understand, the Israelites are gone, okay? The people are still around, but the identity of the Israelites are now gone. 539, Cyrus the Great conquers Babylon, okay? And he says, I want the Israelites to return to Jerusalem. It's called the Edict of Cyrus, all right? And this is celebrated in the Bible. What is controversial is, why would he do such a thing, okay? Because again, the Israelites are now gone. The Israelites who went to Babylonia, they may still keep their religion a bit, but they no longer have their land. They have changed as a people, okay? So as an Israelite, you pray in the temple, but the temple is now destroyed, so now you pray in the synagogue, okay? So the people have changed a great deal. So the question now is, why would Cyrus the Great go to Babylon and say, you know what, I want you Israelites to return to Jerusalem. I want you to reconstitute the nation of Israel. Why would he do that? Okay, so this is going to be a debate that will never, ever end, okay? So the Bible tells us that Cyrus the Great did this because God told him to do that. Very, really simple. God says, I love my people, the Israelites, send them home. Okay, and Cyrus the Great says, yes, of course, you're the great God, I'll do so, okay? Guys, that's not what happened, okay? All right, so there are different explanations. Maybe the idea is that Cyrus wants to show all the Persian Empire, I'm religiously tolerant. You can practice your religion, you can celebrate your religion. That's what the Persian Empire is, an open, tolerant, generous empire, okay? That's true. What's also true is that Cyrus found himself as a righteous and merciful king who wanted to be generous to everyone, okay? So he saw the Israelites want a home and says, well, then go home, okay? It's also possible that there's a faction within the Israelites who supported his Babylon takeover, okay? I don't know if this is true, it's probably not true, but we consider that as a possibility, that the Israelites in Babylon supported his takeover, and so to thank them, Cyrus said, fine, I'll give you back Jerusalem. Another possibility is that when Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon, he discovered that, you know what, these Israelites are really good administrators. And this is true throughout history, because remember, the Israelites had their Bible, and their religion requires them to study the Bible. And as we discussed, the Bible is one of debate, openness, asking questions. And so these are very literate intellectuals. And they rise up very high in the Babylon administration. But this is true throughout history, where Jewish people will rise very high in all empires, including the Islamic Empire, including the American Empire, okay? I think the best reason for what happened is divide and rule, okay? So the idea is that you need to control the Levant, because Levant gives you access to Egypt, which is historically the wealthiest part of the world, okay? Whoever controls Egypt controls the world. So what you do is you set up a group of people in the Levant that are only loyal to you. Okay, does that make sense? Okay? You set up people in the Levant that only exist because you, the empire, allow them to exist. If you, the empire, did not support them, then the locals, everyone in that region would get rid of them right away, okay? And that's why we have the Jews. So the Jews were invented by the Persians to control the Levant. The Jews is actually a Persian term, okay? So before the Jews were, of course, the Israelites. Now we have the Jews. All right, so this is Jerusalem. And as you can see, what's really important to understand is that this is actually only a really small part of the Levant. But this part is specifically for the Jews. And it's part of this Persian province called Beyond the River. Okay. And they call it the province of Yahu. That's why we have the term Jews, okay? Because they are part of the province of Yahu. And what's really important to understand is they're surrounded by enemies. The Sumerians are Israelites who have stayed in the Levant. Okay, do you understand? So most people around them are, in fact, Israelites who adapted to local circumstances. And that means that they practice different religions. That also means that they married foreign women as well. But they still consider themselves as Israelites, okay? Right? Does that make sense, guys? So, what happens is that these exiles from Babylon, they come back, and they say, no, we're the true Israelites. You guys are the false Israelites. The reason why we're true is we have stayed loyal to our religion. Okay? So what's going to happen over the next few decades is almost a civil war between Israelites who've stayed and Israelites who left but come back. All right? And this is what the Persian Empire wants in order to maintain stability in the Levant. Right? Because you have this small minority of exiles from Babylon who've come back, and they're in conflict with everyone else. Alright? This is divine rule. Okay, so So could you help me read the Bible, okay?
Okay.
Alright, so we're gonna read two books of the Bible. They're called Ezra and Nehemiah, okay? And these two books are really important, and they're not really discussed that often by scholars, but Ezra and Nehemiah shows us how Persia helped the Jews to reconstitute their nation, the process. And by studying these two books, it will give us insight into how current people in the nation of Israel think. And then we can analyze how they will behave moving forward, okay? All right, so can you read? This is the beginning of the book of Ezra, okay?
In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in order that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia, so that he sent a herald throughout all his kingdom, and also in a written edict declared.
Okay, so this is really important for us to understand, okay? According to the Bible, Cyrus is doing this because God told him to do this. Okay? Not because of imperial ambitions or imperial strategy. It's just God told him to do this, okay? Keep on going.
Thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of those among you who are of his people, may their God be with them, are now permitted to go up to Jerusalem in Judah and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let all survivors, in whatever place they reside, be assisted by the people of their place with silver and gold, with goods and with animals, besides freewill offsprings for the house of God in Jerusalem.
Okay, so Cyrus the Great is considered the Messiah by the Jews. The Jews are extremely thankful for Cyrus, because not only does he allow them to go back to Jerusalem, but he also finances the rebuilding of the temple, okay? But when this happens, when they go back and try to rebuild the temple, the locals get pissed off, okay? Because, like, who are you people? You're stealing our religion. Like, what's going on here, okay? And this creates a lot of conflict. That's good for the Persian Empire because they want this conflict, right, as part of their divide and rule strategy, okay? All right.
When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments were stationed to praise the Lord with trumpets, and the Levites, the son of...
Okay, the Levites are important. Levites are actually the priest class of the Israelites, okay? Keep on going.
The sons of Asaph, with cymbals according to the direction of King David of Israel, and they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever towards Israel. And all the people responded with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of families, old people who had seen the first house on its foundations, wept with a loud voice when they saw this house, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping, for the people shouted so loudly that the sound was heard far away.
This is the happiest moment in Jewish history, when they rebuild the temple, okay, what they call the Second Temple. And this is important because the Second Temple was destroyed. And what they want to do now in Israel is build the Third Temple. And this is important because the Third Temple sits on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in the Islamic world. So what this Bible is telling us that eventually the Israelis will destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque so that they can build the Third Temple, or what they call the Temple of Solomon, okay? All right, can you continue?
When the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of families and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your gods as you do."
Okay, so they're saying, we're Israelites just as you guys, okay? We stayed, but you guys left. So actually, we're better than you are, okay? Because we stayed, whereas you left. Okay, keep on going.
And we have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of King Esarhaddon of Assyria, who brought us here. But Zerubbabel, Jerusha, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of families in Israel said to them, "You shall have no part with us in building a house to our God, but we alone will build to the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus of Persia had commanded us."
This is really weird, right? You're all Israelites. Why is it that no, we are the true Israelites, you guys are the false Israelites, and so you can't help us. Okay? Why is there this conflict going on? Right? That's strange. And so the only way to understand this is the conflict is part of the imperial strategy. Okay? Divide and rule. Keep on going.
Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and they bribed officials to frustrate the plan throughout the reign of King Cyrus of Persia and until the reign of King Darius of Persia.
Okay, so they try to build the temple, but it doesn't really work out because there's so much opposition, right? the Jews who've come back from Babylon, it's like, we're the real Israelites, so only we can touch the temple. No one else can participate. And the others are like, This is wrong. We should all participate in the building of the temple. This is one religion, okay? So it seems as though these Jews from Babylon, they're actually imperial agents who are trying to sow discontent within the region. Okay? Sorry, this is a bit long, okay? But can you try to read?
Okay. This is a copy of the letter that King and... Can you help me?
Artaxerxes, okay?
Artaxerxes.
Artaxerxes is this great warrior in Persia, okay? Great warrior. Keep on going.
Gave to the priest Ezra, the scribe, a scholar of the text of the commandments of the Lord and his status for Israel.
Okay, so Ezra is one of these Israelites who comes from a family that was exiled to Babylon. Okay? But he's a priest and he's an intellectual. So he is considered actually the creator of the Bible that we have today. Okay, keep on going.
Artaxerxes, king of kings, to the priest Zerah, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, peace. And now I decree that any of the people of Israel, of their priests or Levites in my kingdom who freely offers to go to Jerusalem may go with you. For you are sent by the king and his seven counselors to make inquiries about Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand, and also to convey the silver and gold that the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and gold that you shall find in the whole province of Babylonia, and with the free will offerings of the people and the priests given willingly to the house of their God in Jerusalem. With this money, then, you shall, with all diligence, buy bulls, rams, and lambs, and their grain offering and their drink offerings, and you shall offer them on the altar of the house of your God in Jerusalem.
Okay, stop. Okay, this is really important. Okay, this is a letter by King Artaxerxes authorizing Ezra to build the second temple. Okay, why is this important? Because this is called the Balfour Declaration, 1917. What's going to happen is that the British government, Lord Balfour, he writes to Lord Rothschild, who is a Jewish financier, and he says, actually, just read this, okay?
Okay. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation.
Okay, this is almost like the Artaxerxes declaration, right? You see how in the Bible, Artaxerxes writes a letter to Ezra and says, hey, I authorize you to go back to Jerusalem and build the second temple, right? So what's happening is that they're using the Bible as a script in order to facilitate their geopolitical ambitions. Okay, this is why reading the Bible is important. Because once you read the Bible, you understand the Bible, you compare it to historical development, you're able to see the connections. And if you're able to see connections, you can also see, predict how they will develop over time. Okay? So this Balfour Declaration creates the current nation of Israel, okay, which was founded in 1948. So like before, the nation of Israel was created by the British as part of their geopolitical strategy of dividing and conquering the Middle East. And we'll discuss this later on, okay? But it's really important for you guys to keep in mind as we move forward. All right, can you read the highlighted part, okay?
Okay. Oh my God, I'm too ashamed and embarrassed to lift my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads.
Okay, so this is a speech by Ezra, okay? He returns to Jerusalem, and now he has to reflect on what God wants, okay? So he's going to discuss why God exiled him to Babylon, why God has allowed him to return, and what God wants him to do, okay? Keep on going.
and our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. From the days of our ancestors to this day, we have been deep in guilt, and for iniquities, we, our kings and our priests, have been handed over to the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plundering, and to utter shame, as it now the case.
Okay, so why did the Israelites get exiled to Babylon? Because they refused to obey and worship Yahweh. Yahweh sent prophets. Yahweh warned them, but they kept on worshiping false gods. They kept on sinning. And so Yahweh's like, you know what? I really need to teach these guys a lesson. And that's why they exiled him, they exiled them to Babylon, so they can reflect and learn and grow as a people. Okay? Keep on going.
But now for a brief moment, favor has been shown by the Lord our God, who has left us a remnant and given us a stake in his holy place, in order that he may brighten our eyes and grant us a little sustenance in our slavery. For we are slaves, yet our God has not forsaken us in our slavery, but has extended to us his steadfast love before the kings of Persia, to give us new life, to set up the house of our God, to repair its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah,
and Jerusalem.
And in Jerusalem.
Okay, so Ezra's saying, okay, yeah, we screwed up, but God is forgiving, and now we have a second chance to prove ourselves to God. How do we prove ourselves to God? By making sure that we only worship him, okay? So this beginning of Jewish monotheism, okay? Which was heavily influenced by Zoroastrianism. So in other words, the religion that the Jews will practice from now on is not the religion of the Israelites, which is polytheistic. They will now practice a new religion that's heavily influenced by Zoroastrianism, okay? Which is the Persian religion. Keep on going.
And now, our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you are commanded by your servants, the prophet, saying, the land that you are entering to possess is a land unclean with the pollutions of the people of the lands, with their abominations. They have filled it from end to end with their uncleanness.
Okay, so this is a really important idea to understand. What Ezra is saying is this. These Israelites who've stayed are traitors. They are now unclean. Why? Because now they worship foreign gods. They're polytheistic. And as a result, we have to clean the land, okay? This is a fanatical understanding of Judaism. Okay, keep on going.
Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters from your sons, and never seek their peace or propriety, so that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever.
Okay, keep on going.
After all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserved, and have given us such a remnant at this, shall we break your commandment again and intermarry with the people who practice these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you destroy us without remnant or survivor? O Lord, God of Israel, you are just, but we have escaped as a remnant, as is now the case. Here we are before you in our guilt, though no one can face you because of this.
Okay, so now God has forgiven us. We've returned to Jerusalem. We can't screw this up again, okay? And how do we prove our loyalty to God? By making sure that we are pure, okay? We're not going to marry other religions. We're not going to marry other people. We're just going to marry within ourselves. So Herodotus, in his histories, when he talks about the Jewish people, okay, he says that Jewish people are known for two things. The first thing they're known for is keeping Sabbath on Saturday. So they don't work on Saturday because that's their law. The second thing that they're known for, really known for, is they don't marry outside their religion. Jewish women will refuse to marry foreign men, okay? And so now we have the concept of blood purity. That is new. So remember, it's really important for us to understand, but the Jews and the Israelites are not the same people, okay? In fact, what Ezra is doing is rejecting the Israelite heritage and establishing a new heritage based on blood purity and a monotheistic devotion to Yahweh. And this is new, okay? That's why I keep on saying this. The Jews of Persia are not the same as the Israelites of David. All right. So as you can see from this map, the Jews are in this area. And it's a very small part of the Levant. But it's a part of the Levant that's completely loyal to Persia. Okay, because they see everyone else as unclean, as the enemy. And if you're an empire, having the Jews around are really good for you, right? All right? And so the Jews are an invention of the Persians, but guess what? The nation of Israel is also an invention of the British Empire, and we'll discuss this later on. All right, so we move on to the second book called Nehemiah. So Ezra is the priest who will create the Bible. Nehemiah is the governor sent by the Persians to reestablish the Jewish nation. Okay, so okay, can you read the highlighted part?
At the time, I was cupbearer to the king.
Okay, cupbearer to the king is like a really powerful position, right? Because you can poison the king. So the king loves you. The king sees you as someone who is very competent. And you could possibly be one day be prime minister or the first minister. Okay, keep on going.
In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King
Artaxerxes,
my bad. When wine was served him, I carried the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had never been sad in this presence before. So the king said to me, "Why is your face sad since you are not sick? This can only be sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my ancestors' graves, lies waste and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What do you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. Then I said to the king, "If it pleases the king and your servant has found favor with you, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my ancestors' graves, so that I may rebuild it." The king said to me, the queen also was sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a date. Then I said to the king, "If I pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may grant me passage until I arrived in Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, directing him to give me timber to make beams for the gates of the temple fortress, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy." And the king granted me what I asked, for the gracious hand of my God was upon me.
Okay. So the Bible says that Nehemiah one day feels tremendous regret that the city of his ancestors has not been rebuilt. Okay, and he begs the king for permission to go back. Guys, this is not how empires work. Okay, this is not how empires work. You do not ask the king or the emperor for anything because he will just cut your head off. Okay, how empires work is that you have to read the king's intentions. Right, you have to figure out what does he really want. And then you have to say, "Please, please, I want to do this. Not because you asked me to do this, but because I want to do this myself." Okay? And I will work hard to achieve this ambition. That's how empires work. All right? The king does not tell you what he wants. You have to guess what he wants. If you can guess what he wants, then you get promoted. If you can't guess what he wants, then you get your head cut off. All right? That's how empires work. This is important because when we move on to the nation of Israel, most people believe that the nation of Israel started with the Zionist movement, which came with the writing of a book called Judenland, Fatherland, written by this German Jewish journalist called Theodor Herzl. And so people say Zionism started 100 years ago. Guys, when we do the next state of Israel, we will discover that it's actually part of the British imperial policy. Okay, but the British themselves cannot be seen as the ones who are promoting the creation of the state of Israel because it makes them look bad. Okay, because everyone else would be like, "Why are you doing this?" So what they have to do is create a situation in which the Jews themselves are trying to want to create their own nation. The problem, though, is this is really important. We'll discuss this later. Is that 100 years ago? Guess what? Jews did not want to go to Jerusalem because they were happy where they were. Okay, there were a lot of Jews who were pretty happy in Babylon, but they were sent back in order to create this province, Judah. And to create all this conflict with the locals. Okay? That's how empires work. Okay. All right. So when Nehemiah goes back, what he's going to do is he's going to build the temple and he's going to build the walls. This is going to piss everyone off, right? Because, like, why would you do that? We're all living happily together. We're all one big family. And now you're building these walls, which means that you're better than us, or you're afraid of us, or you want to conquer us, okay? So this creates all these conflicts with the locals, which is, again, what the Persian Empire wants to happen. This is how empires work. All right. Okay, can you read?
Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish kin. For there were those who said, "With our sons and our daughters, we are many. We must get grain so that we may eat and stay alive." There were also those who said, "We are having to pledge our fields, our vineyards, and our houses in order to get grain during the famine." And there were those who said, "We are having to borrow money on our fields and vineyards to pay the king's tax." Now our flesh is the same as that of our kindred. Our children are the same as their children, and yet we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have been ravished. We are powerless, and our fields and vineyards now belong to others.
Okay, so what's happening is that Nehemiah has gone back to create this new province of Jews. What he's discovering is that there's massive corruption and inequality among these Jews. And this is a problem because they're a minority in a very hostile region, right? Keep on going.
I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these complaints. After thinking it over, I brought charges against the nobles and the officials. I said to them, "You are all taking interest from your own people." And I called a great assembly to deal with them. And said to them, "As far as we were able, we have brought back our Jewish kindred who had been sold to other nations, but now you are selling your own kin, who must then be brought back by us." They were silent and could not find a word to say. So I said, The thing that you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies? Moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let us stop this taking of interest. Restore to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their houses, and their interests on money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them. Then they said, "We will restore everything and demand nothing more from them. We will do as you say." And I called the priests and made them take an oath to do as they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my garment and said, "So many God shakes out everyone from house and from property who does not perform this promise. Thus may they be shaken out and emptied." And all the assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised.
Okay, so this is a really important aspect of the Jews that people don't really understand how unified they are, okay? An example is that if you're a Jewish person, you can always get an interest-free loan if you want to buy a house or start a business. Okay, that's pretty amazing, right? If we want to buy a house or want to start a business, we go to a bank, they're like, okay, we're going to charge you 10% interest, and maybe you can't afford that, right? But if you're a Jewish person, it doesn't matter how poor you are, there will always be Jewish organizations that can offer you interest-free loans if you want to start a business, or if you want to buy a house, if you want to do anything. Because Jews are not allowed to collect interest from each other. That's how unified they are as a people. Okay? Okay. So just read the top and the highlight it, and that's it, okay?
Okay. When the seventh month came, the people of Israel being settled in their towns, all the people gathered together into the square before the water gate. They told the scribe Ezra to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel. Accordingly, the priest Ezra brought the law before the assembly, both men and women, and all who could hear with understanding. This was on the first day of the seventh month. He read from it facing the square before the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of the men and women, and those who could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law.
Okay, so this is the last step of creating the Jewish identity, okay? So the idea of the Jewish identity is that they follow the laws of God, they do not marry outside their religion, they don't charge each other interest, they don't exploit each other, okay? And the last thing is this, the last thing is that their historical memory is the Bible, okay? Who are we as Jewish people? What are our memories? It's whatever is written in the Bible, okay? So Ezra is taking all these historical documents and he's combining them together in what today we call the Bible. Okay? And this makes the Jewish people extremely resilient, because no matter where they are, no matter how low the publishing goes, their memory, their historical identity is always stored in one Bible. That makes them the world's most resilient, flexible, and open people. Okay? So this begins the Bible. Okay? Keep on going.
In those days, I saw in Judah people treating wine presses on the Sabbath.
And Sabbath is a Saturday, the day of rest. Okay?
And bring in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys, and also wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them at the time against selling food. Tyrians also, who lived in the city, brought in fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them on the Sabbath to the people of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I remonstrated with the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing that you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your ancestors act in this way, and did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on the city? Yet you bring more worth on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." In those days also I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke the language of various people. And I contended with them, and cursed them, and beat some of them, and pulled out their hair. And I made them take an oath in the name of God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters from your sons or for yourselves." Did not King Solomon of Israel sin on account of such women? Among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women?
Okay, so Nehemiah enforces two major laws. The first law is that you shall not work on the Sabbath, because that is God's rest day, okay? Second major law is that if you marry a foreign woman, you must divorce her. He's bringing up families. Why? Because he believes that religious purity requires blood purity. If you marry a foreign woman, she's going to make you believe in their foreign god. Remember, it is by worshiping false idols. It's because of this that Yahweh decided to punish the Jews. Okay, so the Jews must only worship Yahweh. All right, so this is their interpretation of monotheism. So as you can see, there are certain traditions about the Jews that was created during the Persian Empire in order to facilitate Persian control of the Levant. But these traditions, because they are encoded in the Bible, they stay with us even today. But not only that, but by reading the Bible carefully and understand how to connect the Bible to historical development, you can now figure out how Israel will develop over the next 10, 20 years, okay? And these are my, these are my three predictions. First of all, they're going to rebuild the Temple of Solomon. Okay, they're going to build the third temple by destroying the Isaac Mosque. They're going to do that sooner or later, okay? That's the first thing they're going to do. And you, can, you know why, because when we read the Bible, you can see how happy they were, okay? Because they felt completed. They felt as though God is with us, God has forgiven us, God loves us, okay? So building the third temple is crucial to the identity of Israel today, okay? So they're going to do this, and it's going to cause a lot of problems because, again, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest site in the Islamic world. And it's going to create a lot of conflict between Israel and the Islamic world, okay? Do they care? Not really. Okay, number two, you can see how when the Jews returned, they were convinced that they were forced out of Jerusalem because they offended God, okay? So, in other words, if Jews want to maintain control over Israel, they need to obey the laws of God, which means that they become a theocracy, okay? Now, I'm not sure if you've been to Israel. I've been to Israel. And if you go to a place like Tel Aviv, it's a very open, liberal, cosmopolitan, forward-looking place, okay? I think that Tel Aviv has one of the world's highest concentrations of gays in the world, okay? Guess what? That's gone, okay? As Israel develops over time, it's going to become more and more of a theocracy, where the Bible is the law, okay? And the third thing is that we can expect that as the Pax Judaica expands, more and more Jews will return to Israel. Look, the reality is this. If you look at the Middle East, Israel is the greatest power in the Middle East. There's no force in the Middle East that can prevent Israel from expanding and expanding, including the Pax Judaica, which is their ambition, okay? So this is just an introduction. But the thing I want you guys to remember is that, first of all, the Jewish identity, it is fluid, it's flexible, it's open, and it's created by empire for the purpose of maintaining empire. Okay? And we're going to see this throughout history as well. All right? So, was this clear to you guys? Are there any questions about today? Okay? Yeah?
So, how does the Persian state control, like Persian control of Jerusalem transfer to modern day society? Like, how does it still work? Because I think we're seeing like a trend that is Israel's going kind of more back to like depending on the Bible and everything. So how does it like transfer to modern day society and all the conflicts that's happening?
Okay, so Persia wanted to divide and conquer the Levant, okay? They're afraid that if the Levant becomes too stable, the Levant might side with Egypt or another power, and they lose control of the Levant, which directly impacts their capacity to trade and control the world, okay? So the way you control the Levant is you create this entity that is in conflict with everyone else. And now what happens is that both this entity, Jerusalem, and its enemies rely on you, Persia, to manage the conflict. Okay? And this is what's happening today in Israel, because who's the empire? America's the empire, right? Israel has all these conflicts with nations in the Middle East, right? They have conflicts with Turkey. They have conflicts with Egypt. They have conflicts with the Gulf nations. They have conflicts with basically everyone, okay? So who does everyone need to manage this conflict? America, right? Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, Egypt, they all require the United States to come in and say, hey guys, let's just get along. We're just one big family, okay? This is all intentional in order for America to maintain dominance over the Middle East. Who's very unhappy about this? Which nation is very unhappy about this? Israel, okay? Right? Israel's kind of pissed about this. So we can expect that over time what's going to happen is a major, major conflict between America and Israel. There's going to be a divorce, basically. And my argument to you is that Israel will win this conflict, and as a result, Israel will become the dominant power in the Middle East. Because the Jews know their own history. The Jews read the Bible every day. They know what the Persians did. They know what the British did. They know what the Americans are doing today. They don't want this. They don't want to become a servant, a slave to empire. They are servant and slave to their God, but they don't become a servant and slave to the empire. So they need to get rid of the empire and establish a sovereignty. Okay, and that's why there's so much conflict in the Middle East today, because Israel needs to figure out how to get rid of the American empire so that they can be independent and fully achieve their sovereignty. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think one question I have is about, like, I think currently the Jews stop attacking Palestinians?
Okay, guys, okay. This is really important, okay? Don't say the Jews, okay? There are different groups. There's the Israelites. The Israelites are the time of King David. They're gone, okay? Let's forget about the Israelites. There are the Jews, and the Jews are people who practice Judaism, okay? Then there are the Israelis. Israelis are citizens of the nation of Israel. It's the Israelis that are doing this, not the Jews. There's a difference, okay? Because the Jews are spread out throughout the world, okay? What we call the Jewish diaspora. And there are a lot of Jews in the world who oppose the nation of Israel because, well, what the nation of Israel is doing, they believe goes against the will of God, okay? So Israelis, not Jews, okay?
Okay, so the Israelis is, I think, like, the news just disappears about how Israelis attacks Palestine. It's just because previously it was, like, all on the hot searches, but recently we can it's just gone, the news is.
Okay, look, the reality is that if you read the Bible, it's clear what's going to happen. Israel is going to clear the West Bank and Gaza of Palestinians to establish their theocratic state. Okay, they can't have Palestinians and Arabs around. It has to be completely Jewish. And these Palestinians can be moved elsewhere, to Jordan, to Egypt. They don't really care, okay? But this process will take time, okay?
Okay.
All right. Any more questions, guys? Okay, great. So was this clear? The ideas in this class are clear, okay? So next class, what we'll do is we'll do the Greek Empire, okay? And then after that, we'll do the Roman Empire. And after that, we will do Christianity. Okay, so we're going through history fairly quickly. But I need you to keep these ideas in mind because it will build on top of each other. Okay? All right. Okay, thank you.